Welcome back. I'm glad you decided to stick around. If you've just added the class, make sure you go back through the week one materials before you look at week two. You'll want to look at the in-class folder at the bottom as well and work your way through ICA 1 topic concept mapping. Although you can't receive credit for it, you're welcome to use it to flesh out a research idea and send it to me for feedback. This week, we'll further develop what you might want to research this semester and how you want to approach that topic. Required sources 1 and 2 are focused on the process of focusing your topic. Remember that for this class, you'll choose a single topic and work on it all semester, so it should be something you're interested in. Here are a few key requirements of the class that may help guide how you choose your topic. 1. You should be able to find scholarly sources on the topic, so don't limit yourself to doing background research on Wikipedia, though you may find some scholarly articles in the references pages there too. Use a scholarly database on the Stockton website. Google Scholar may also be helpful, but has some limitations we'll eventually talk about. 2. You should choose a topic you are genuinely interested in, not one you think I want you to focus on. It doesn't have to be related to your major, your planned career path, or anything else. It should be something that interests you. Good research starts with questions you have about something. 3. You may need to think outside the box, and that's okay. I've seen students choose some really interesting topics they were convinced they'd never find scholarly sources on. There are a lot of ways to make a non-academic topic academically oriented. Over the years, quite a few students have told me they wished I would just assign research topics to them, but I feel strongly about not doing that. Can you imagine researching the decline of amphibian populations in Argentina if you didn't care at all about that topic? I'm not generally in the business of torturing my students, though you may feel differently as the semester progresses. Here are a few strategies that might help you finalize your topic. 1. Talk about research ideas with a friend or family member. Sometimes the people closest to us notice things we seem to be interested in before we do. 2. Make a list of all the things that come to mind in a 3-minute period. Do you notice any trends in what you've written? Maybe that points to something you'd like to know more about. 3. Use the Wikipedia random article link, optional resource 1, a few times until something interesting appears. This is a great time for us to start talking about Wikipedia's usefulness for research, too. Over the years, Wikipedia has gotten a bad rap. I still know educators who have a blanket, don't use it policy, and I think that's a shame, because as the resources in this week's folder point out, it can be really helpful for generating ideas, conducting background research, and finding additional sources. I hope in your educational experience, you've been encouraged to use it in these ways, and if you haven't, you will be this semester. One reason a lot of educators are still funny about Wikipedia is that there persists the notion that anyone can change any article at any time. While that certainly used to be true, it's not anymore. Articles that draw a lot of criticism or opinion are generally locked by administrators, so only certain experienced editors can change them. There's also a useful flag system for identifying articles that are missing important information or citations. I generally advise ignoring articles with red flags at the top and being cautious with those that have yellow flags. Here's how I find Wikipedia most useful for researchers. 1. It's a great starting point if you're brainstorming ideas or just want some background information on a topic. 2. There are a bazillion links at the end of strong Wikipedia articles that will take you to the sources, writers, and editors referenced in the body of the article. You can follow them to find all kinds of useful information. And 3. There's usually a references list at the end that points readers to books, films, and other sources that might be helpful. Like any other source you might use for research, scholarly or otherwise, Wikipedia is only as good as the effort you put into using it. It's always true, regardless of what source you're consulting, that you should put a critical eye to it, ask questions about truth claims you see, and verify facts and figures. Good Wikipedia articles help you do that by being explicit about where the information came from. So yes, I'm a fan. That said, you shouldn't ever consider it a scholarly source, a point we'll talk about more in depth later. It's good at this stage to remember that the research process is not usually linear, moving from one task to another in a specific, one-directional order. It's much more a cycle, and that cycle begins with picking a topic, conducting some preliminary research to determine whether it's viable for this class, going back and refining or tweaking it, doing some more preliminary research, etc. We call processes like these iterative, meaning you come up with an idea, test it out, and adjust as needed. You will generally repeat this process, continually adjusting and hopefully improving your approach throughout the semester. Once you've landed on something that interests you, it's important to narrow that topic down to a researchable question or problem. One way to do that is to revisit the topic concept map we did in class in week one. After you've selected and refined your topic to something realistic and manageable for you, start looking for more specific background information that will help you define your research question and thesis statement, which will shape your whole semester and which will be our focus next week. For the second part of our content this week, I want to focus on cognitive biases, why they matter, and how they can negatively impact research. Cognitive biases are a risk for any researcher, whether they're just starting out on their research journey or they're seasoned scholars with lots of publications under their belt. Why? Because the human brain is both an amazing tool and a master of deception. If you've ever taken Intro to Psychology or a course like it, you've probably heard of cognitive bias. Most professionals define cognitive bias as a systematic error in thinking, and it can happen for a wide variety of reasons. On the one hand, our brains are wired for bias as a kind of survival mechanism. Imagine you're walking down a dark alley in an unknown city, and you see a man in dark clothes coming toward you. Your instinct, especially if you're a woman, might be to walk faster or to turn around and run the other way. This response ultimately stems from your brain's biased beliefs, that a woman alone in a dark alley is not safe, that men walking down dark city alleys are dangerous, that men who wear dark clothes while walking down unlit alleys are trying to blend in so no one sees them, possibly meaning they have nefarious purposes like robbing unsuspecting strangers, etc., etc. These beliefs may come from personal experience or social programming, but they are nevertheless meant to protect you. Sure, you're making a bunch of generalizations about this stranger you don't know. He could be a nice guy taking a shortcut across town or searching for his lost dog, but it's a risk worth taking to stay alive and in one piece. Other cognitive biases stem from our flawed memories, what we tend to pay attention to, and what we want to be true. That's when you start getting in trouble. The number one bias you must watch out for in research is confirmation bias, the tendency to pay attention to information that conforms to your existing beliefs. This too has a self-protective function in that we want to enlarge the size of our social groups by sticking with people like ourselves. Unfortunately, it's also a significant contributor to social and political division. If I'm conservative, I'm more likely to read right-leaning news sources. If I'm liberal, I'm more likely to read left-leaning news sources. If I'm moderate, I will struggle to find moderate news sources, because the media, like humans, trends toward extremes. The more I dig into the community of which I'm a part, the less I am exposed to beliefs different than mine, and the more right I think I am. We become more and more entrenched in our beliefs, and people on the other side seem more and more like the enemy. There are many, many cognitive biases. Some are more relevant to research than others. Anchoring bias, the tendency to rely on the first piece of information you learned about a topic, is a very real risk in research. There's something about that early information that doesn't want to give up its place in our brains. Attentional bias means you have a tendency to pay attention to certain information and dismiss other information. This isn't always a bad thing. Some information really isn't worth giving the time of day. But it can be similar to confirmation bias, making it incredibly hard to see other sides to an issue. Sometimes, the Dunning-Kruger effect takes hold, making you believe some people are smarter and therefore more trustworthy or reliable than they really are. The thing about biases is that you can't possibly control for all of them in research. It would be a full-time job. But being aware they exist and being willing to identify and question your assumptions throughout the research process is key to avoiding some of the most significant negative effects of these biases. I can give you lots of examples of how I've seen this in research, but the most perfect one comes from an Intro to Research student I had in 2021. She wanted to research a very public conflict a pop star was dealing with, but the more I encouraged her to seek out opposing or differing viewpoints on the issue, the more she dug in her heels. One day, she came up to me after class, exasperated with my repeated advice. She said, "I don't think I can research this, because I know my opinion is right. I'll never be able to see the other side." I was proud of her for being honest with both of us, and I had kind of seen this coming. While I would rather have pushed her into that uncomfortable place of having to look at the other side, I admired her ability to say it just wasn't going to happen because of how strongly she felt about the topic. So she chose another topic about which she had a little less emotional investment, and her project was fantastic. All of this brings me to what I call the single story effect. Maybe others have called it this as well, but I haven't come across the term yet. Maybe you're already familiar with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's work. Her TED Talk, The Danger of a Single Story, is 16 years old at this point and has circulated the internet millions of times. Rather than require you to watch or read the whole TED Talk, I've included a quick summary I found useful. But if you're interested, I did include a link to the talk as optional source too. I suspect one of the reasons people like Adichie's talk so much is that it resonates with us. She starts by talking about her experience growing up in Nigeria as a book-obsessed child who read British stories more than Nigerian ones because of their broad availability. That impacted her understanding of what British and other non-Nigerian people were like. As she began writing, those preconceptions found their way into her own stories, because while she lived in Nigeria and was Nigerian, she didn't think Nigerians like her wrote books. It seemed important to her that she write stories that were accessible to others, and that meant British. She also talks about misconceptions Americans had about her when she moved to the U.S. to go to college, and the misconceptions she had about Americans. Her stories are funny when you listen to them. Why don't people realize Africa is a continent, not a country? But they're also quite telling. Adichie brings to light an important point about storytelling, and while she's mainly talking about fiction, I see research as another form of storytelling, so I think her talk is very applicable to what you'll be doing this semester. We all fall into the single story trap at some point or other. That is, we create a single story about a group of people, a geographic region, a phenomenon, and we hold on to it with all our might, often without realizing it. We don't want to let it go because it's comfortable and familiar, and frankly, learning we might be wrong is uncomfortable. Now let us briefly apply this to research. You're choosing your own topic this semester. You will presumably choose a topic because you're invested in it in some way. You care about it. So what's your single story about that topic? What's your single story about the people or places involved in it? What's your single story about your side of the issue and about people on other sides of the issue? What do you believe to be true? And perhaps more importantly, what will shake up your beliefs such that you can open yourself to the possibility that you're wrong, partially or entirely? I want to be clear here. I'm not saying your thesis is wrong. I'm saying it very well could be, but you won't know that unless you get out of your single story bubble. You have to pull multiple stories into your sphere of influence to understand the issue in all its complexity, and you can't do that until you acknowledge that you have a single story. Maybe you don't. Maybe you don't have strong feelings about the issue one way or the other. But I suspect you do, because it's hard to develop a thesis without taking a position, and it's hard to take a position if you don't care whether you're right or wrong. So some self-evaluation is required here before you begin that research process. That's why we'll do a researcher self-evaluation together in class. Hope you found this a helpful overview for the week. As always, let me know if you have questions or concerns, and I'll see you soon. Focus your topic. From the Research Process Library Guide at the University of Michigan Thompson Library. Keep it manageable and be flexible. If you start doing more research and you're not finding enough sources that support your thesis, you may need to adjust your topic. A topic will be very difficult to research if it is too broad or narrow. One way to narrow a broad topic, such as the environment, is to limit your topic. Some common ways to limit a topic are by geographic area. For example, what environmental issues are most important in the southwestern United States? By culture. For example, how does the environment fit into the Navajo worldview? By time frame. For example, what are the most prominent environmental issues of the last 10 years? By discipline. For example, how does environmental awareness affect business practices today? By population group. For example, what are the effects of air pollution on senior citizens? Remember that a topic may be too difficult to research if it is too locally confined. Topics this specific may only be covered in local newspapers and not in scholarly articles. For example, what sources of pollution affect the air in Genesee County? If they're too recent, if a topic is quite recent, books or journal articles may not be available, but newspaper or magazine articles may. Also, websites related to the topic may or may not be available. If it's too broadly interdisciplinary, you could be overwhelmed with superficial information. For example, how can the environment contribute to the culture, politics, and society of the Western United States? and if it's too popular. You will only find very popular articles about some topics, such as sports figures and high-profile celebrities and musicians. Putting your topic in the form of a question will help you focus on what type of information you want to collect. Using Wikipedia effectively, from the Introduction to College Research online open access text. According to the article How to Use Wikipedia Wisely, quote, "To tell students not to use Wikipedia is to deprive them of one of the most useful tools on the internet. Instead of teaching them to avoid it, we should be teaching students how to use Wikipedia wisely." End quote. Misconceptions and benefits. Wikipedia, the world's largest reference website, is broadly misunderstood. Since its creation in 2001, and as of November 2020, it had 1.7 billion unique visitors monthly, and more than 55 million articles in over 300 languages. Because it is written by thousands of anonymous volunteers around the world, Wikipedia generates uncertainty or skepticism in many. If just anyone can change Wikipedia, won't there be inaccuracies? Won't people potentially abuse that power? The open, collaborative approach of Wikipedia means that it is susceptible to vandalism, unverified information, or subtle viewpoint promotion. On Wikipedia, vandalism refers to editing an article in a malicious manner that is intentionally disruptive, whether the edits are humorous, nonsensical, a hoax, or degrading. However, that same open approach also increases the chances that factual errors and misleading statements will be quickly corrected, and that articles will be consistently improved and updated. Indeed, an often-cited 2005 study by Giles, as well as a follow-up study in 2012 by Caseborn and other researchers, found no significant differences in accuracy between Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica articles. Additionally, the Wikipedia community has strict rules about providing citations or references for facts and claims, and authors must adopt a neutral point of view. Because of this, Wikipedia articles are often the best available introduction to a subject. If you're researching a complex question, starting with the resources and summaries provided by Wikipedia can give you a substantial running start on an issue. For more information about this, see the section in this textbook on background reading. The requirement for Wikipedia authors to cite their sources has another beneficial effect. If you can find a claim expressed in a Wikipedia article, you can almost always follow the footnotes to reliable sources for further research and evidence. Areas for caution. Not all Wikipedia articles are useful. Some articles are incomplete or contain citation needed warnings. You may find very short stub articles that are awaiting either further expansion or deletion. According to Wikipedia itself, quote, "A stub is an article which is deemed too short and incomplete to provide in-depth encyclopedic coverage of a subject." As of 2025, almost half of Wikipedia's articles could be considered stubs. End quote. You should avoid using these types of articles for your research. Another known concern is systemic bias in Wikipedia, including gender and racial bias. For example, of the over 130,000 active editors of Wikipedia, only 8.5 to 16% are female. Of the over 1.5 million biographies on Wikipedia, only 18% are about women. Wikipedia has launched numerous initiatives to encourage more women to become editors and to improve their coverage of women. Even so, the gender gap persists. With Wikipedia, as well as other more traditional forms of publishing, we must be aware of who creates the information we consume and understand how that impacts our knowledge about research topics and the world around us. For more on bias, see the page in this text on information sources, bias. Using Wikipedia wisely. With an awareness of these benefits and concerns, you can more effectively use Wikipedia for fact-checking and to find background information on a topic. Listen to the following video that addresses some of the common misconceptions about Wikipedia and demonstrates how you can use this tool wisely, as professional fact-checkers often do.
Many educators tell students they shouldn't use Wikipedia because it's full of mistakes and anybody can edit a page. If that's the case, then why, in our observations of professional fact-checkers, was Wikipedia one of the first sites they often consulted? It's true that there are mistakes in Wikipedia, A 2005 study from Nature found that the typical Wikipedia science article had 4 mistakes. But the same study found that the typical Encyclopedia Britannica entry contained 3 mistakes. In contrast to a print encyclopedia, Wikipedia allows for changes to be made almost immediately and for information to be kept current. And it's not true that anyone can edit any Wikipedia page. Many of the most viewed entries are locked, which means that only high-level Wikipedians can change them. To tell students not to use Wikipedia is to deprive them of one of the most useful tools on the internet. Instead of teaching them to avoid it, we should be teaching students how to use Wikipedia wisely. When fact-checkers go to Wikipedia, they scan the body of an article, but what they are really looking for is the goldmine of sources at the end of the article. For example, the American College of Pediatricians has an official-sounding name and logo. It's easy to think that it's the main organization of pediatricians in the country. But even a quick scan of Wikipedia shows that not to be the case. But the real evidence comes at the bottom, in the references Wikipedia requires in substantiating a claim. In a matter of seconds, students can find in these references a letter from Francis S. Collins, the head of the National Institute of Health, condemning this small group for misrepresenting his research findings. This brings the trustworthiness of the American College of Pediatricians into question. And fact-checkers don't just examine one source. They look at multiple sources. Used properly, Wikipedia is an invaluable resource, especially as a launching pad for evaluating online information. We need to teach students how to use it wisely.
How cognitive biases influence the way you think and act. Are you aware of yours? By Kendra Cherry, updated May 7th, 2024, on the Very Well Mind website. A cognitive bias is a systematic error in thinking that occurs when people process and interpret information in their surroundings, influencing their decisions and judgments. The human brain is powerful, but subject to limitations. Cognitive biases are often a result of your brain's attempt to simplify information processing. Biases often work as rules of thumb that help you make sense of the world and reach decisions with relative speed. Some of these biases are related to memory. The way you remember an event may be biased for a number of reasons, and that in turn can lead to biased thinking and decision making. Other cognitive biases might be related to problems with attention. Since attention is a limited resource, people have to be selective about what they pay attention to in the world around them. Because of this, subtle biases can creep in and influence the way you see and think about the world. The concept of cognitive bias was first introduced by researchers Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman in 1972. Since then, researchers have described a number of different types of biases that affect decision-making in a wide range of areas, including social behavior, cognition, behavioral economics, education, management, healthcare, business, and finance. Cognitive bias versus logical fallacy. People sometimes confuse cognitive biases with logical fallacies, but the two are not the same. A logical fallacy stems from an error in a logical argument, while a cognitive bias is rooted in thought processing errors, often arising from problems with memory, attention, attribution, and other mental mistakes. How do you know if you have a cognitive bias? Everyone exhibits cognitive bias. It might be easier to spot in others, but it's important to know that it's something that also affects your thinking. Some signs that you might be influenced by some type of cognitive bias include only paying attention to news stories that confirm your opinions, blaming outside factors when things don't go your way, attributing other people's success to luck, but taking personal credit for your own accomplishments, assuming that everyone else shares your opinions or beliefs, learning a little about a topic, and then assuming you know all there is to know about it. When you're making judgments and decisions about the world around you, you like to think that you're objective, logical, and capable of taking in and evaluating all the information that is available to you. Unfortunately, these biases sometimes trip us up, leading to poor decisions and bad judgments. One of the biggest challenges regarding cognitive biases is that it's often hard to recognize our own biases or those of others around us, says licensed psychologist David Sussman, PhD. Also, while we may be able to eventually identify some of our own most common cognitive biases, it's a much more difficult task to help others spot and change their biases. Types of cognitive bias. Learn more about a few of the most common types of cognitive biases that can distort your thinking. Actor-observer bias. This is the tendency to attribute your own actions to external causes while attributing other people's behaviors to internal causes. For example, you attribute your high cholesterol level to genetics, while you consider others to have a high level due to poor diet and lack of exercise. Anchoring bias. This is the tendency to rely too heavily on the very first piece of information you learn. For example, if you learn the average price for a car is a certain value, you will think any amount below that is a good deal, perhaps not searching for better deals. You can use this bias to set the expectations of others by putting the first information on the table for consideration. Attentional bias. This is the tendency to pay attention to some things while simultaneously ignoring others. For example, when making a decision on which car to buy, you may pay attention to the look and feel of the exterior and interior, but ignore the safety record and gas mileage. Availability heuristic. This is placing greater value on information that comes to your mind quickly. You give greater credence to this information and tend to overestimate the probability and likelihood of similar things happening in the future. Confirmation bias. This is favoring information that conforms to your existing beliefs and discounting evidence that does not conform. False consensus effect. This is the tendency to overestimate how much other people agree with you. Functional fixedness. This is the tendency to see objects as only working in a particular way. For example, if you don't have a hammer, you never consider that a big wrench can also be used to drive a nail into the wall. You may think you don't need thumbtacks because you have no corkboard on which to tack things, but not consider their other uses. This could extend to people's functions, such as not realizing a personal assistant has skills to be in a leadership role. Halo effect. Your overall impression of a person influences how you feel and think about their character. This especially applies to physical attractiveness influencing how you rate their other qualities. Misinformation effect. This is the tendency for post-event information to interfere with the memory of the original event. It's easy to have your memory influenced by what you hear about the event from others. Knowledge of this effect has led to a mistrust of eyewitness information. Optimism bias. This bias leads you to believe that you are less likely to suffer from misfortune and more likely to attain success than your peers. Self-serving bias. This is the tendency to blame external forces when bad things happen and give yourself credit when good things happen. For example, when you win a poker hand, it's due to your skill at reading the other players and knowing the odds, while when you lose, it's due to getting dealt a poor hand. The Dunning-Kruger effect. This is when people believe that they are smarter and more capable than they really are. For example, when they can't recognize their own incompetence. At times, multiple biases may play a role in influencing your decisions and thinking. For example, you might misremember an event, the misinformation effect, and assume that everyone else shares that same memory of what happened, the false consensus effect. What causes cognitive bias? If you had to think about every possible option when making a decision, it would take a lot of time to make even the simplest choice. Because of the sheer complexity of the world around you and the amount of information in the environment, it's necessary sometimes to rely on some mental shortcuts that allow you to act quickly. Cognitive biases can be caused by a number of different things, but it is these mental shortcuts, known as heuristics, that often play a major contributing role. While they can often be surprisingly accurate, they can also lead to errors in thinking. Other factors that can contribute to these biases include emotions, individual motivations, limits on the mind's ability to process information, and social pressures. Cognitive bias may also increase as people get older due to decreased cognitive flexibility. Why is cognitive bias bad? Cognitive biases can lead to distorted thinking. Conspiracy theory beliefs, for example, are often influenced by a variety of biases. But cognitive biases are not necessarily all bad. Psychologists believe that many of these biases serve an adaptive purpose. They allow us to reach decisions quickly. This can be vital if we're facing a dangerous or threatening situation. Here's an example of a helpful cognitive bias. Say you're walking down a dark alley and spot a dark shadow that seems to be following you. A cognitive bias might lead you to assume that it's a mugger and that you need to exit the alley as quickly as possible. The dark shadow may have simply been caused by a flag waving in the breeze, but relying on mental shortcuts can often get you away from danger in situations where decisions need to be made quickly. How do you break cognitive bias? Research suggests that cognitive training can help minimize cognitive biases in thinking. Some things that you can do to help overcome biases that might influence your thinking and decision-making include being aware of bias. Consider how biases might influence your thinking. In one study, researchers provided feedback and information that helped participants understand these biases and how they influence decisions. The results of the study indicated that this type of training could effectively reduce the effects of cognitive bias by 29%. Considering the factors that influence your decisions. Are there factors such as overconfidence or self-interest at play? Thinking about the influences on your decisions may help you make better choices. Challenging your biases. If you notice that there are factors influencing your choices, focus on actively challenging your biases. What are some factors you've missed? Are you giving too much weight to certain factors? Are you ignoring relevant information because it doesn't support your view? Thinking about these things and challenging your biases can make you a more critical thinker. Challenging others' biases. Respectfully pointing out biases in others can also help others think more critically, especially if they're unconsciously acting or speaking on their biases. Even if we can't change others' biases, remember they may be at play when we find ourselves in a disagreement with someone who seems very entrenched in their own viewpoint, Sussman explains. Rather than confronting them directly about how inaccurate or irrational we think they are, it's often more productive to present facts and information in a non-directive way and ask them to consider an alternative point of view or some point of compromise. Reducing cognitive bias may also be beneficial in the treatment of some mental health conditions. Cognitive bias modification therapy, or CBMT, is a treatment approach based on processes that are designed to reduce cognitive bias. This form of therapy has been used to help treat addictions, depression, and anxiety. Avoiding confirmation bias, from the Introduction to College Research open access text. What is confirmation bias? Here's a quick definition from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Quote, the tendency to process information by looking for or interpreting information that is consistent with one's existing beliefs. End quote. Although confirmation bias is typically unintentional, it is strong and widespread, with many significant effects and real-world implications. As the Encyclopedia Britannica definition goes on to point out, confirmation bias is important because it may lead people to hold strongly to false beliefs or to give more weight to information that supports their beliefs than is warranted by the evidence. People may be overconfident in their beliefs because they have accumulated evidence to support them, when in reality they have overlooked or ignored a great deal of evidence refuting their beliefs, evidence which, if they had considered it, should lead them to question their beliefs. These factors may lead to risky decision-making and lead people to overlook warning signs and other important information. In this manner, confirmation bias is often a component of black swan events, which are high-impact events that are unexpected, but in retrospect, appear to be inevitable. Also, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica article, confirmation bias has important implications in the real world, including in medicine, law, and interpersonal relationships. Research has shown that medical doctors are just as likely to have confirmation biases as everyone else. Doctors often have a preliminary hunch regarding the diagnosis of a medical condition early in the treatment process. This hunch can interfere with the doctor's ability to assess information that may indicate an alternative diagnosis is more likely. Another related outcome is how patients react to diagnoses. Patients are more likely to agree with a diagnosis that supports their preferred outcome than a diagnosis that goes against their preferred outcome. Both of these examples demonstrate that confirmation bias has implications for individuals' health and well-being. In the context of law, judges and jurors sometimes form an opinion about a defendant's guilt or innocence before all of the evidence is known. Once a judge or juror forms an opinion, confirmation bias will interfere with their ability to process new information that emerges during a trial, which may lead to unjust verdicts. In interpersonal relations, confirmation bias can be problematic because it may lead a person to form inaccurate and biased impressions of others. This may result in miscommunication and conflict in intergroup settings. In addition, when someone treats a person according to their expectations, that person may unintentionally change their behavior to conform to the other person's expectations, thereby providing further support for the perceiver's confirmation bias. Impact on searching. Some psychologists describe confirmation bias as the selective collection of evidence that supports what one already believes, while ignoring or rejecting evidence that supports a different conclusion. Experiments have found repeatedly that people tend to test hypotheses in a one-sided way, by searching for evidence consistent with their current beliefs. Rather than searching through all the relevant evidence, they phrase questions to receive an answer that supports their theory. One of the primary types of confirmation bias is the biased search for information. When you type a search or a question into Google, you will want to be careful that your choice of keywords does not unintentionally reflect a bias towards pre-existing beliefs or toward a particular preconceived answer. Here are some examples. A search for "Is rent control unfair to landlords?" is likely to get results that describe rent control as unfair to landlords. A better search might be something like "Rent control landlords." On this page is an image of a Google search for "rent control unfair to landlords." The top search result is an article called "Why Rent Control is Unfair and Hurts Landlords" from AOAUSA.com. A search for "Are immigrants hurting the economy?" is likely to get results that argue that immigrants hurt the economy. A better search might be something like "Economic Effects of Immigration." And here is an image of a Google search for "Are immigrants hurting the economy?" The first result is from Politico.com, entitled "Yes, Immigration Hurts American Workers." The second result is from The City Journal, and is titled "How Unskilled Immigrants Hurt Our Economy." Summary: The Danger of a Single Story, by Nermeen Shumpert, in the fall 2018 issue of the online journal Interpolations, from the University of Maryland's Department of English. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's The Danger of a Single Story TED Talk in July 2009 explores the negative influences that a single story can have and identifies the root of these stories. Adichie argues that single stories often originate from simple misunderstandings or one's lack of knowledge of others, but that these stories can also have a malicious intent to suppress other groups of people due to prejudice. People, especially in their childhood, are quote-unquote impressionable and vulnerable when it comes to single stories. Adichie asserts that media and literature available to the public often only tell one story, which causes people to generalize and make assumptions about groups of people. Adichie shares two primary examples to discuss why generalizations are made. Reflecting on her everyday life, she recalls a time where her college roommate had a quote-unquote default position of well-meaning pity towards her due to the misconception that everyone from Africa comes from a poor, struggling background. Adichie also clearly faults herself for being influenced by the single-story epidemic, showing that she made the same mistake as many others. Due to the strong media coverage on Mexican immigration, she bought into the single story, automatically associating all Mexicans with immigration. These anecdotes emphasize how stereotypes are formed due to incomplete information, but one story should not define a group of people. Adichie also tackles the effect of political and cultural power on stories. Power not only spreads a story, but also makes its ideas persist. Adichie states that power can be used for malintent through controlling, quote, how stories are told, who tells them, when they're told, and how many stories are told, end quote. Using power to manipulate our understanding of others can be evidenced by Adichie's trip to Mexico, where she realized Mexicans were not the harmful Americans Western media had portrayed them to be. Additionally, influential Western stories have caused people like Adichie to have a limited idea of characters that appear in literature, since foreigners were not part of them. This is why the first stories Adichie had written included white characters playing in the snow rather than things reflective of her life in Africa. Adichie explains how she became enlightened through the discovery of African writers, which, quote, saved her from having a single story of what books are and becoming another victim of a biased sample of literature, end quote. Adichie puts her speech in a nutshell, stating that, quote, to create a single story, show a people as one thing, as only one thing, over and over again, and that is what they become, end quote. Her conclusion responds to these misconceptions by reiterating the importance of spreading diverse stories in opposition to focusing on just one. She professes that the rejection of the single story phenomenon allows one to regain a kind of paradise and see people as more than just one incomplete idea.